Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Black athletes occupy a rare place in our society. They are symbols of racial progress. To those without any connection to the black community, they are the most visible examples of black Englishness available. But sports also reflects, reinforces and challenges the racial disparities common in our society, often in front of our eyes, often without us being aware of it. On the surface, sport provides positive images of black people, but does it also reveal society's deep-rooted rejection of black Englishness? No Win, No Race attempts to answer this question. It's the new book by Derek Bardawell, covering the period between the Brixton riots, 1981, and Brexit. No Win, No Race tackles race and racism in modern England through the prism of sport. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, author of No Win, No Race, Derek Bardawell. Derek, good morning to you.
Hi, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Glad to have you on this morning of all mornings as well. We couldn't have picked a finer morning to be doing it, really. On the surface of it, you would say that sport is the great leveler. There is, you know, on the playing field, everybody is equal. Everybody is judged by their performance. Your book goes to disprove that theory, you could argue.
Yeah, I mean, what I say in the book is that, you know, on the surface, you see lots of representation of people of colour, which is incredibly positive. And I think, you know, that's, for me, how me and my dad and me and my son really bonded. You know, we watch sport and it's really great. But as you'll know, what lurks beneath the surface in terms of, you know, the leadership of sport and who gets to sign the checks, who has the power, isn't as equal as perhaps it should be, or as equal as the representation on the field of play. And I guess the book tends to unpick some of that historically and look at some of the reasons why that has occurred.
I mean, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, your book starts at, you know, after the Brixton riots, 1981, yep. And I, at that time, would be around 13, 14, so started sort of watching sports, you know, rather than, you know, a little boy would watch it, you know, with a better idea. And one of the things that you cover in sports is, I mean, I remember quite a few famous, the Three Degrees, as they were known. I mean, I'm from the Midlands. I'm from Stoke-on-Trent. And I remember when people like Laurie Cunningham and Cyril Regis first burst onto the scene. And I remember Garth Crooks, and I'd said this previously. Garth Crooks, when he came back to Stoke-on-Trent, he was met with a wall of bananas when he first played, which, I mean, at the time was thought not acceptable, but it wasn't. If that happened in today's football, there'd be games would be shut down.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot imagine what people like Garth Crooks, the late Cyril Regis, and all of those guys had to go through, because essentially, for us to have progressed, and again, you know, the book does offer some hopeful solutions or cautious solutions to some of these predicaments, but none of that would have occurred had those great footballers in the late 70s and early 80s really made those breakthroughs, and also, you know, dealt with it in the way that they did. I think what we've seen is that there's been a great deal of progress in terms of the numbers of black players that, in particularly football, has got higher. But as I said, there's still lots of issues around things such as management and access to getting behind the boards in terms of sport in that way. And you almost need a bit of a revolution in that sense to really make some of those changes, particularly in light of, you know, people like Raheem Sterling and others still facing that level, not that same level of abuse, but certainly an unacceptable level of abuse, not just here, but abroad.
Well, I mean, Raheem Sterling brought that up. And I mean, you know, it's only 30 years since, you know, somebody, or 40 years since Cyril Regis was sent, you know, a bullet in the post. Yeah. And didn't Rio Ferdinand get that as well when he called out John Terry?
Yeah. I think the fallout from the case with John Terry, I think Rio reported or you know said in the papers a few years ago that there was also bullets. So it's you know it's the thing that's lying underneath the surface that's always there. So I think for many many years we've looked at sport as something that has been very equal because for many many years so much of these things have been swept under the carpet, but you know, in light of what happened last night and what's happened over the last, you know, 3 years, particularly with Brexit, I think, and the EU referendum, what we're seeing is a lot of these things haven't necessarily been solved or progressed as much as we think they have. And what we're seeing right now is a real unearthing of some really quite deep divisions within our society. And we're not necessarily seeing the level of leadership from our political leaders at this particular point to really address something that is... quite a desperate situation. There's a lot of pent-up frustrations on all sides here.
I mean, you could argue, and I'm going to get brickbats for saying this, that it's allowing some nice little fun. I had a conversation about this over the weekend with some friends who come over from London about the fact that you talk about empowering people, but what's been happening is empowering that nasty little strain to come up people going about the thing that we must have balance, we must have both sides of opinion, but some opinions really shouldn't be heard, and some of people's opinions are being emboldened. Going back to Raheem Sterling's case, when he was, you know, he seemed to be flashy. He buys his mum a house, he buys a Bentley, and it seemed to be, look at that, it's just a young black dumb footballer, flashy, you know, showing his wealth, and yet... You know, if a white footballer does it, it's not to think, oh, look at him, he doesn't look after his mum.
Yeah, it's, you know, and I think that's the... And where Raheem was really good in terms of pointing out the media's role in this is that for many, many years, you know, the way that the black athlete, particularly those that have, earned a bit of money in their career have been treated is, you know, perhaps going back into the 80s, those athletes would have been subject to media representations that were very, very, just very bold and just incredibly direct in terms of its racism at the time. What's happened over the last few years is that the directness of how those representations are made are not quite as bad on the surface as it was in the 80s, but how it is now is, you know, you're a bit ungrateful or you're a bit flashy or you're hanging around with too many rappers. You know, you get some of those depictions of Lewis Hamilton and a lot of black athletes, which isn't as blatant as the descriptions back in the 80s, but now they are actually influencing lots of people. And as I said, if sport is the lens for lots of people that don't know black people to get in tune with black people, those negative representations often really make some of those athletes, you know, maligned and it antagonizes them. And I think they were absolutely right to call it, Raheem was absolutely right to call it out. But I think he was also right to say, you know, look, this isn't just a sport issue. You know, it's an institutional issue in the UK that includes the media and other institutions. And I think that's important.
Lewis is an interesting one because my father was a professional racing driver and he's BRDC.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, British Racing Drivers Club. And we've never had, there's never been a driver like Lewis in terms of ability, but also in terms of his background. I mean, there was a guy called Jason Watts who was a Danish black driver, but that's about as far as it's kind of gone in terms of any sort of race being involved in motor racing. So the reaction from motor racing fans hasn't been perhaps so tribal as it's been, you know, in that particular sport. But it's an interesting one as well, isn't it? Because we have coloured athletes on the rugby field, coloured athletes on the football field, very few coloured managers. Paul Ince, Sol Campbell, that's about as far as it's sort of gone so far.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment you would say that, and this is historic, so, you know, historically what has happened in, you know, America when Jackie Robinson became the first black player to enter the Major League Baseball scene in the late 40s, you know, what ended up happening was the baseball powers that be ended up very much recruiting all of the players, but they didn't recruit all of the managers. There was some fantastic managers and coaches from what was then deemed the Negro Leagues that was specifically for black players back then. But yeah, the players got through, but the managers and coaches didn't. And that's been the historic problem with a lot of sport in this country, is that we've seen great progression with the athletes, but not necessarily with all of those great coaches. And look, you know, Chris Hughton did a great job at Brighton, got sacked. You know, Sol Campbell, who's, you know, really been fighting to get a managerial role for a number of years, you know, done a great job with Macclesfield. You know, we've got talent that's out there, but let's face it, a black manager is not able to walk into the roles or the same type of roles perhaps as their white counterparts can.
The one of the obviously the sports where athletes of colour excel is the boxing ring, and there is no sport like boxing. And you step into a ring, and I went to see a boxing match a couple of months ago, and I was reminded of how brutal it is and how honest, if you like, it is, because you have nowhere to hide when you step into a boxing ring. And one of your, and I remember this match as well, because I would be again about 13 watching this, when Alan Minter, the great white hope of British boxing, took on Marvellous Marvin Hagler. And I remember the build up, and I remember it was Wembley Stadium, wasn't it? Or it was Wembley Arena. And I remember him stepping in with a Union Jack wrapped, a Union flag wrapped around him, and him being demolished by Hagler. And then the scenes afterwards, which again just were unbelievable. Just because you look at that as well, don't you, in the book?
Yeah, that was like the first encounter with racism, you know, that I ever had, because up to that point, for me, until, you know, the way that Alan interacted going up there saying, a black guy can't beat me, and, you know, there was a kind of jingoistic atmosphere at Wembley Arena and stuff, to my mind, because I was born in England, I was born in London, you know, and because Alan Minter was from England, my support was very much for him. So I didn't have any feelings that would have said, you know, because Hagler's black, I'm going to support the black guy over the white guy. For me, it was very much like Minter's English, and that's it. But that sparked off, that particular incident was the first of many incidents that I had as a kid that was very much negative related to the color of my skin. And so that early clash between where I was born against how I was perceived by other people in this country as a child, from being stopped and searched by the police, having shop owners call the police on me and all of those sort of things. It was like that fight was the first sort of crystallization of what the following years would become for me. And that's where that conflict between, you know, the color of your skin and your country, shared experiences that I would have with other people of color against the shared birthplace, people where you're born, you know, where you had all of those mini conflicts that, you know, many people of color in this country grow up with, you know, in trying to get that sense of belonging. And as I said, I think in recent years, after many years of, I think, some of these things being swept under the carpet, you know, they're really resurfacing again. And again, I think, you know, while there are, you know, a few nasty elements that are really, you know, emphasizing it now, look, there's a deep institutional issue in this country around race and racism, people's inability to talk about it, people's inability to really address it, that goes, you know, far wider than a few rotten apples.
I mean, do you think that, you know, that sports people should be calling out this when they see it? I mean, we talk about Raheem Sterling, and then, you know, I did an interview last year, which I played a bit, you know, a stab there with Frank Bruno, who, if you like, many might criticise him for being the sort of, you know, he was, you know what I mean, Ari, Bruno was seen as a national treasure, and somewhat, those are boxers, somewhat harmless and non-threatening in a way that somebody like Lennox or somebody like Hagler certainly weren't.
Yeah, I reflect on that, you know, when I used to watch Frank, I preferred the excitement and the non-compromising nature of Mike Tyson. That's Mike Tyson, the fighter, not Mike Tyson necessarily the man, you know. That was my lens. And when you reflect on that years later, you absolutely recognize that, it's tough if you're in the spotlight, period. It's tougher if you're a black person in the spotlight. And so for me, you know, Frank Bruno ends up being, as a kid for me, someone that I was like, God, he's not outspoken enough, and why is he, you know, smiling so much, to seeing him a few years later and thinking, my God, it must have been so hard, hearing his responses later on in his boxing career to, you know, it being implied that he was a sellout and him really rejecting that, really, really told me that, look, here was a guy that was in a difficult position, a guy that, you know, carried himself really, really well, a guy that probably had to hide lots of things in order to get on. But, you know, he was very much a hero. You know, he was a massive hero. And there's lots of footballers and lots of players where I say now, look, if you are going to make a stance, I hold my hand up to you, because that's a really tough thing to do. But I would never criticize a player that is not going to do that, because, you know, a sportsman's career is very short. You know, it could be 5 or 6 years, you're a heavyweight fighter, you get knocked out and that's it. You know, you have to make your career. So I'm very sympathetic to those players and those fighters many years on, perhaps in a way that I wasn't when I was a kid. But, you know, sport tends to do that, tends to bring out the worst in you at times.
Of course, over in the States, it's an even more raw experience, and I think that's a kind way of saying it. And you have a look at, you know, the career of people like, you know, Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, who have stayed, if you like, apolitical, not got involved, whereas taking the knee, you know, American football player Colin Kaepernick, of course, and the whole NFL, which had even the US president getting involved.
Yeah, I mean, in America, they've got a really strong history, right through from obviously Muhammad Ali, Paul Robeson, and all of those guys of political activism through sport. So it's always run there. And I guess throughout much of the 80s and 90s, the likes of Tiger Woods and Michael Jordan, you know, were marketing phenomenons, and it didn't really benefit them to really make any major political statements at any point during their careers. I think if you look at the way that people like LeBron James and other sports stars now are managing their careers, they kind of recognize now that, you know, they can earn millions of pounds and, sorry, millions of dollars, be successful, but they can also, you know, be a bit more outspoken than that generation was originally. And again, you know, you would look at them and you would say, okay, well, maybe those guys opened the doors for the likes of LeBron, Dwayne Wade, and others, Colin Kaepernick, to be more outspoken now, and that's a really good thing. But I'd also like to say that, you know, a big part of the book, particularly the final chapter, just really speaks on the role of women here, who I think very often do not get as much credit and are often very much silenced in terms of their activism and their role. And I think when you look at, you know, obviously Serena Williams, when you look at Eniola Aluko and her case a couple of years ago of the FA, when you look at the Women's National Basketball Association, which really supports the activism of their athletes, but, you know, I think their athletes, that their top athletes earn something like, I don't know, $100,000 in comparison to $25, $30 million to their male counterparts, and they're still active voices. I don't think that should be something that should be forgotten.
But, I mean, the problem is the fact that any sport you go to, be it, you know, I mean, you can go, the French, when they won the World Cup in 1998, and they were Les Bleus, and they were, you know, there were Africans, there were Muslims, there were French. I mean, it was it seemed to be a whole nation coming together in a wonderful sort of, you know, multicultural team. But the problem is that that's as maybe, and, you know, the England women's team and the England men's team may again reflect society as it is, and in the cricket team as well. But at the end of the day, sport seems to be controlled by sort of middle-aged white men.
Yeah, and so in that sense, you know, it's a lot of wealth in sport as well, and wherever there's wealth, the people that are in power want to preserve that wealth, you know. And so, you know, unless there is a more progressive agenda around sport, then, you know, it's always going to be a problem. But I look at it this way. I look at, you know, England, when they win the World Cup in football at some point, that will be done with a very... I'm going to be positive.
Right, fair enough, okay.
It will be won in a very different way to how people have supported England in the past. There's been that notion of empire has to be the bonding feature for, you know, England to be successful in football, you know, and I think, what was it, you know... two world wars and one World Cup used to be the chant for many years ago. Look, the team that wins the World Cup for football, our national sport, is going to be a very mixed team. And I think unless you start to have an administration that really recognizes the value of diversity in terms of the success of not just football, but success in this country, you know, we're talking about Great Britain and you're talking about making Britain greater, and diversity is a fundamental part of that. And I think while sport cannot in any way, you know, spark a revolution or anything like that, I think it does symbolize, and that football team potentially with the manager that they've got in Gareth Southgate, as well as the team that they have, which is not just wonderful footballers, but really strong, great characters throughout that team, will come to symbolize something that's very different. But you have to have an administration and management that not only acknowledges that, but has that level of diversity too, if they're to recognize that dream.
So where do you start with the starting point on this, and who do you speak to put together the book No Win Race?
It's been in my head for a number of years. I work in the charity sector and have done for a number of years. So I spent lots of time up and down the country, you know, working with various charities, but also working with organizations that use sport positively to help vulnerable people. And that could be from, you know, older people getting more exercise right through to young people that are at risk of exclusion or gang and knife crime, having, you know, sport as not just a diversion, but a way of being able to engage them in order for them to do educational activities and stuff. So my lens is actually from three perspectives, I'd say. One, as a fan, I love sport and absolutely love sport and can watch it, you know, all day long if I was allowed to.
Yeah, right.
I come from it as being a journalist, so I used to be a journalist many years ago on sports and, you know, interviewed the likes of Lennox Lewis and Denise Lewis and others throughout career. But also in recent years, more coming from the perspective that the lens of sport is the power of sport is really strong. And I've seen where that power can be, you know, almost transformational in the lives of young people and communities. And I guess for me, that lens is the strongest in terms of where I come from the book, in that level of input, the people that I've met who are doing all of these wonderful things in charities across the country, I always wonder why they are not our leaders. Why are they not, part of the sporting administration? You know, I did an event last week with Empire Fight and Chance, which does unbelievable work in Bristol with young people, as well as producing world boxing champions. You know, they're able to do the engagement stuff as well as producing world champions like, you know, Lee Selby. That's amazing to me. And I would love for more people to know more about, you know, organizations like them, like Fight for Peace and others who are doing magnificent stuff, which is not just about supporting vulnerable young people, but it's also they're producing really good and great athletes, and I think there's a story to tell there.
So where do you think we go from here then, Derek? Do you think it's a case of getting more people of colour in, you know, a higher up in the echelons of the people who actually pick the teams and who govern the sports?
Yeah, I think that's a key thing. And I think, you know, it's not just people of colour. You know, as I said, I think there's lots of people from the development field. And when I say development, I say, you know, the social sector, who are doing incredible things within sport that is transformational. And so for me, I think it's not just about, you know, having tokens around the table and saying, oh, we need, we have 12 white male board members. We need to have a woman in there. We need to have a disabled person in there. And we need to have a black person in there. No, it's actually about really looking at what do you need to be an effective in your sport. And we've seen it in you know, different areas like cycling, you know, where within a 20-year period that transformed. For me, in terms of administration, diversity and inclusion shouldn't be a position in, you know, we have a role for diversity and inclusion in director. No, your key people that are your heads need to be recruited on the basis of their track record in diversity and inclusion. It needs to be embedded. And, you know, as I said, I think there's lots of people of color who I highlight in the book, as well as lots of people in the development field who I also highlight in the book, who I would call the unsung heroes, the local heroes, who you would say, my God, sport is great over here, but it could be much greater if more of those people were playing a more active role in the development of the sport. And it really does need a strong input of those people to make things a lot better in the future.
The book is called No Win Race, A Story of Belonging, Britishness and Sport. It's out now on Mudlark. It's by Derek A. Bardwell. Derek, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, do you do the social media thing? Is there a website?
There's not a website. My Twitter feed is at Derek A. Bard. That's D-E-R-E-K A. Bard, B-A-R-D. So, you know, you can get to me on that Twitter handle.
And having an interview, who is the sports person then? I'll put you on the spot now. Who is the sports person that, you know, made you sort of sit up and take notice and say, you know, if you had to pick one, that's the person to put the marker down and that's the person that we should be following or should be taking inspiration from?
Historically, obviously Muhammad Ali, so, you know, that goes without saying. But Muhammad Ali, in terms of what he did, was absolutely incredible. But, you know, I am still a really massive fan of Anthony Joshua, and maybe that's because I'm still a massive, you know, boxing fan and stuff. But I think that moment when he fought Dillian White, you know, 3-4 years ago, and Stormzy was singing Shut Up in the ring, was just a real big moment for Black Britain and sport in this country. For me, it was the moment which really said, you know, we've arrived, this is us, we belong, we're reclaiming our space in this country. I think it was just a really huge moment, and I think, you know, I still think he's a huge figure and going to play a huge role in that transformation in that way.
I mean, I mean, Tyson Fury against Joshua, it's got all the potential of being such a clash of everything, hasn't it?
It's a clash of everything, but, you know, it's quite interesting because on the Tyson Fury front, I know there was that documentary recently on, you know, mental health with, you know, the footballers and Prince William and stuff like that.
Hello? Oh, good grief. Yeah. We just lost you for a second there, sorry.
Oh, sorry. No, I was just going to say it was a magnificent show, but, you know, it would have actually been interesting watching someone like Tyson Fury talking about some of his mental health issues as well, because, you know, I think he's got a lot to say about that as well, you know, and how his comeback's brilliant. But let's face it, Joshua versus Tyson Fury is the biggest fight in British boxing history, so yeah.
Absolutely. The book is called No Win Race. It's by Derek Bardwell. Derek, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Brilliant. Thank you. Really nice speaking to you as well, Giles.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.